I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Her passion for the law is anything but academic. She's often referred to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, for whom she clerked, as her hero. I understand that he reciprocated by calling her Shorty.
President Obama introducing his Supreme Court nominee, the diminutive Elena Kagan, at the White House today. She has a towering resume, currently the Solicitor General, the lawyer representing the government before the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan was also the first female dean of the Harvard Law School and domestic policy advisor in the Clinton administration. But she was never a judge, something Republicans say leads to questions about her experience, but seemed to be what Obama was looking for. Remember his musings in the past about nominees with empathy? Well, today, he said Kagan would look at law not as an intellectual exercise, but as how it affects the lives of ordinary people. And she spoke about being the daughter of a public school teacher and a lawyer for tenants' rights.
My parents' lives and their memory remind me every day of the impact public service can have. And I pray every day that I live up to the example they set.
We want to spend a few minutes today parsing the nomination of Elena Kagan. With us, Emily Bazelon, senior editor for Slate Magazine. Emily, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
And Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Michael, welcome to you, and we want to start with you. You had an observation about the court after this announcement this morning.
I think the court, there's a lot of focus on diversity. The court now becomes, I think, entirely Ivy League. six Harvard and three Yale, I think, is
right.
Where we're at this point.
Well, Emily, we should note that besides being an editor at Slate, you have 2 degrees from Yale. But weigh in on this, because I just want to, people are talking about the diversity of the court. Yes, she would be, if she passes muster in Congress, she'd be the third woman on the court, the only time that's happened. But others have pointed out the court is tilted heavily Ivy League, heavily East Coast, heavily work in government and academics rather than real world private practice. So what does she bring that's, as President Obama said, of the people?
Well, there obviously are different kinds of diversity, but I think we're going to hear a lot about Harvard, about the elite academy. Senator Leahy said this morning that he was excited about her in part because she comes from outside the judicial monastery, and that's true. But she's certainly no Earl Warren in the sense that Earl Warren was the governor of California before he joined the court. And usually, when we talk about breadth of experience, it's that kind of elected official, political, real-world experience that we have in mind.
Well, and Michael, let's talk about Harvard a little bit. As we said, first female dean at Harvard. This is before she came to the current Obama administration as Solicitor General. And she had enemies all over the place, but also huge fans. She chose a middle path when allowing military recruiting on campus, even though it violated Harvard school policy of banning companies that discriminate. Now, in this case, she spoke out against Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but she didn't join professors asking then-President Larry Summers to sue the government. So some on the left said she could have done more. Tell us a little bit about how that's going to come up in hearings.
You know, I think most people expect that may be the one most explosive back and forth that we have in the hearings, but also in the next 6 or 7 weeks as we kind of go through this process of exploration, both within the Senate, but also just in the public. Keep in mind, though, that it's an example of kind of the rest of her career, which is that she's been very careful. She's not been somebody who's written a ton. She doesn't obviously have decisions because she's never been a judge, so you can't parse those decisions. And she's been very private as a person about her background and history. And so, that incident on Harvard's campus is very much like the rest of her life. There's not a whole lot to grab onto yet.
But isn't that exactly, Emily, what the president sort of wants first, that it's someone without a paper trail, but also someone who both sides can gripe at? He's presenting her as a consensus builder.
Yes, I think it's useful to the president that she is being attacked from the left as well as on the right for this question about the military recruiting and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. so I, you know, whether that indeed means that she would be a consensus builder on the court, I think we don't really have the answer, and the White House is asking its supporters to trust it, essentially, on that front, given her lack of a long, extensive paper trail.
Well, another thing President Obama made pains to say today is that Kagan is someone who might have irritated some on the left by reaching out to conservatives when she was Harvard dean. Now, we remember she famously brought in Jack Goldsmith, who was a George Bush White House lawyer, and there was a rebellion on the faculty of Harvard in that matter. Now, he turned out to be someone who spoke out against the George Bush White House, but initially the faculty there thought he'd maybe written the terror memos. He did not. But just give us a little sense of how that line today, reaching out to conservatives, and her experience at Harvard, how that might, you know, play out.
Well, I think that's really true about her. I mean, in a bunch of these instances, what you see is that she has not taken the knee-jerk doctrinaire liberal position. And remember, you know, when you're in a school, a law school, inside the academy, things can look different from inside than they do to the rest of the world. And someone like Jack Goldsmith, who turned out to be rather critical of the Bush administration, could seem initially beyond the pale. She sort of refuses to fall for those misunderstandings, and I think that does reflect an openness to different points of view that is very attractive to the Obama administration.
Well, and Michael Shearer, some have said also that she may act as a counterweight to Justice Roberts. Tell us a little bit about, in a funny way, their parallel lives.
Right, you know, both Harvard Law, both you know, sort of had the same kind of intellectual background as opposed to a more real-world background like you might have found in Sotomayor. But what President Obama's top aides have said for several weeks now is that the president has been looking for somebody to provide a kind of heft and not be just a reliable, you know, liberal vote on the court, but to be somebody that could eventually take a real leadership role. And I agree with Emily that it's not clear, you know, whether she will or can. I mean, that kind of thing develops over many years, I think. But I think there's the hope on the president's part that she can become somebody who can not only be a sort of leading dissenting voice, but somebody that can shape and mold the court enough to actually get some consensus opinion.
Well, I'm wondering too, Emily, staying with Justice Roberts, they have this other interesting parallel reality in that they both had nominations to lower courts blocked. Hers was blocked by Republicans at the time. His was blocked by Democrats at the time. He was actually appointed by George H.W. Bush to his chair before he went to the Supreme Court. And doesn't that somehow knock out the argument that she doesn't have, judge experience? Because, in fact, it was a Republican Congress that blocked it. And when he got his, he only had it for a little while before he went to the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, there's this funny history here. John Roberts' nomination gets blocked in the early 90s. Elena Kagan is nominated by President Clinton toward the end of the Clinton administration. Senator Hatch is chair of the Judiciary Committee for the Senate. He refuses to bring Kagan's nomination up for a vote. It dies, and then it takes George W. Bush until 2003 to succeed in filling that seat with John Roberts. But while I think that the fact that the Republicans blocked her nomination is kind of a twist in this, it's still true that she simply does not have judicial experience. That fact is out there for them to trumpet. I just don't think that in the end that's going to kill her nomination.
Oh, it's funny. You mentioned in your article, Emily, in Slate, titled Untried, Untested, and Ready, that in fact there might be a little bit of anger on the left that she bypassed an older woman who did have experience.
Right. I mean, and this, again, I think is actually helpful to the Obama administration politically. But from the point of view of the left, you have Judge Diane Wood of the Seventh Circuit, who has actually done what, you know, liberals want to see in a judge before that person goes up to the Supreme Court. She has been very forceful. She has convinced conservatives on the Seventh Circuit to agree to positions they were previously skeptical of. But she is 10 years older than Kagan, and she has actually written about abortion in a way that takes them. In fact, her positions are in the mainstream, I would argue, but it takes a little explaining. And Kagan doesn't have the same kind of soundbite fodder on these hot button issues that Wood had.
Although she had a very funny line at, I think it was her hearing for Solicitor General, when she was asked about a paper she wrote as a younger person, and this is the paper trail, you know, that people are saying is missing. She had written one paper, I can't even remember what the topic was, she was asked about it, and she immediately diffused the tension by saying, you know, I looked at that, and that's the stupidest thing I ever said. So she kind of diffused it that way. But Michael Scheer, trying to figure out where Elena Kagan may stand on certain issues, she was in the Clinton administration. Do we learn anything from that?
Sure. You'll learn a little bit about positions that she took in the Clinton administration. But whenever you're with an executive branch, you know, the defense that you can always make and the defense that she'll make as part of having been Solicitor General under this administration is that you're essentially carrying out the executive's wishes. It's not your opinions necessarily. You're doing a job. I think what you are already seeing is the kind of questions among even on the left, people saying, we just don't know much about her. I'm reading a statement from the Center for Reproductive Rights, quote, however, her public record reveals very little about her judicial philosophy or her views on the constitutional protections in Roe versus Wade. So, you know, you already have this sense that that even her supporters are kind of scratching their heads a little bit and saying, well, what do we grab onto?
Yeah. Well, so with the couple minutes we have, what do you both think? Emily, start with you. Do you think that she will make it through the nomination process in the 6 or 7 weeks the Obama administration is hoping for?
Yes, I think barring some political bombshell, she has a lot going for her in the same way that Sotomayor did. She, you know, is very appealing personally. She has this fabulous smile. There's very little that the, I mean, in reading this morning what conservatives are going after her for, they just don't really have much. And the left is not super excited about her, but the left will fall into line because there's going to be a lot of reassurances for people who know her personally that she will be a forthright, you know, liberal spokesperson on the court. So, yes, I would say barring something going really wrong, she will be the next Supreme Court justice.
Michael Scheer, you agree?
I agree with that. The only thing I would say is that, you know, this is all playing out in the context of a political campaign. We're right before the midterm elections, and so I think that both sides, all sides, will kind of use this as a way to whip up stuff and whip up issues that might or might not catch fire, and so you'll see quite a lot of heat during the next 6 or 7 weeks.
Well, Michael, I just want to ask you in the few seconds we have, that if she does pass muster, that would mean a court with 6 Catholics and 3 people of the Jewish faith. Sort of, you know, completely shifting from the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant makeup for years, male Protestant for years of that court.
Well, and there's another diversity piece as well, and that is geographic, which used to be much more important on the court. Now you have one sole person in Anthony Kennedy on the court who's left of the west, who's west of the Mississippi, and so, you know, there's all sorts of ways to dice and slice it, and it will be interesting to see whether if President Obama gets another choice, whether he makes any attempt to kind of rectify some of that.
A white guy from the west.
There you go.
Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Emily Bazelon, senior editor for Slate Magazine. As always, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
See ya.
And when we come back, there's a growing support for nuclear power plants, but there may be a cautionary tale from Vermont, as we'll hear in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Well, the giant dome didn't work, so now BP is scrambling for another way to contain its oil gusher in the Gulf. Among the ideas, lowering a smaller dome, a box known as a top hat, or trying to plug the well by injecting debris, including golf balls, into the well. That's called a junk shot. Meanwhile, the BP disaster is strengthening the call for new sources of energy, including nuclear power. A recent Gallup poll shows 62% of Americans are for nuclear, as are the co-founder of Greenpeace and the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. The president has called for a new nuclear era. But there might be a cautionary tale in Vermont, where the state Senate recently voted to shut down a 38-year-old plant. The decision isn't final, but it could have impact beyond Vermont. Science writer Barbara Moran wrote about Vermont Yankee in the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. And Barbara, can you just give us a little background on that plant, when it started to run into problems?
Vermont Yankee is one of four nuclear power plants in New England. It's the only one in Vermont. It provides about 30% of Vermont's power. And until recently, I don't think most people in Vermont thought about it very much at all. And that changed in about 2007, where part of the cooling tower collapsed. And the cooling tower at Vermont Yankee is not the iconic gray hourglass thing that you think of when you think of Three Mile Island. It's this long wooden structure where the steam used to make electricity is turned back into water. And a wooden beam there collapsed, and there was this huge gash in the side of the wall with water pouring out. And, you know, it doesn't sound very good for a nuclear power plant to have part of the cooling tower collapse. And people started to wonder, like, what is going on down there, right? And so that's going on, and that's kind of in the back of people's minds. And what happened this year, in January of this year, was that they had discovered a leak of radioactive material called tritium in the groundwater. That was sort of bad enough, right? That sounds pretty bad, radioactive material in the groundwater at the plant. But what was even worse is that Vermont Yankee officials had testified before Vermont officials several times saying that they had no underground piping carrying radioactive material. These tritium leaks had been an issue at other nuclear power plants across the country, and people were worried about it. But Vermont Yankee people said, oh, no, that can't happen here. No worries. And then it does happen. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for Vermonters.
Even people who backed the plant, you quote politicians saying, if they had wanted to foul this up, they couldn't have done it worse.
Absolutely.
And when you say that people don't think about it, of course there are anti-nuclear activists thinking about it all the time, and they came to the fore.
Absolutely. And Vermont has a very strong anti-nuclear contingent. And they have been protesting Vermont Yankee all along. And then when this happened, they really jumped all over it. And even very pro-nuclear senators and other people who wanted to keep the plant open just felt the tide of public opinion turning against it.
So as you write, you know, how you feel about nuclear power, for most people, has to do with emotions. And this was a kick in the gut. Like, wait a second. Nobody got sick, but there's radioactive material in the groundwater. They promised that would never happen.
Yes.
And suddenly the tide gets completely turned in Vermont.
Absolutely. And the whole, you know, nuclear power, while it is more popular now, as the Gallup poll indicates, there's still a lingering mistrust among the American public.
So why have so many high-profile environmentalists actually changed their tune about nuclear power?
It's climate change. Environmentalists have long disliked nuclear power because of the toxic waste issue and the possibility of a catastrophic meltdown. Now, the big question is climate change. Nuclear power is green in that it doesn't emit any carbon, unlike coal plants or other power. So weighing the question of carbon emissions versus the toxic waste issue, these prominent environmentalists have come out in favor of it. Not all environmentalists have come out in favor of it. A lot of them are still on the fence, are still very anti-nuclear. And one of the reasons is that in order for nuclear power to supplant coal in this country, you'd have to at least double the number of nuclear power plants. So right now there's 104. So we're talking like 100 new nuclear power plants in America to supplant coal. And for a lot of environmentalists, that is just too much to swallow. They might be able to say, well, maybe a couple here and there, but 100 more is just too much.
Well, at a cost of $5 to $10
right.
billion
right.
apiece,
exactly.
That's a factor. But we know that there are many on the drawing board. So how do you see the Vermont story impacting the national story? Because as you said, it's a different kind of plant and it's a different procedure. In Vermont, the state does vote on nuclear power licenses.
Yes. So Vermont is the only state that has this unique power over relicensing. Other states don't really have a say in it. It's just the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the federal agency, says this plant will be relicensed or not relicensed. Mm-hmm. So it's really a federal issue. However, there's no reason why other states couldn't start claiming these powers.
States don't have the right now to vote it down, but they could vote in environmental laws. They
exactly.
could vote in energy planning laws. They could do other things that could slow down.
That's exactly right. And a lot of states have long thought that this issue is in the hands of the federal government. They don't really have any say. And then they might look at Vermont and say, maybe we could get this.
Well, the future of Vermont Yankee is sort of hanging in the balance right now.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
The state has said no, but the feds can come back and say yes, and then the state will have to say no again, and
yep.
so that there could be a pitched battle there.
Exactly.
But in the meantime, what is the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is there are no easy choices, really, when it comes to America's energy future. Vermont Yankee is a plant with problems, but it provides 30% of Vermont's power. Environmentalists will say, well, we'll just replace that with wind. And if the plant closes down in 2012, you're not going to replace it with wind. You're not going to replace it with wind like that. The DOE predicts 40% rise in electricity demand over the next 30 years in the United States. If we want to meet this rising demand with the current mix of energy sources, we will require 230 new coal plants, 160 wind farms, and 10 nuclear power plants. I don't see any of that happening. Nobody really wants 230 new coal plants. Nobody wants to cut back all the electricity use. There's just going to have to be some tough choices going on in America.
Barbara Moran, science writer for the Boston Globe, will link you to her article in the Sunday magazine at our website, hereandnow.org. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, as we said, the call for more nuclear plants is fueled by the oil disaster in the Gulf. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll take a look at BP's long history of drilling for oil and its safety record. Also tomorrow, Songs for Soldiers, rock music written by and for combat vets. That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. World markets surged today after the European Union approved a nearly $1 trillion plan to prevent the debt crisis in Greece from spreading to other Eurozone countries. Meanwhile, in Greece, the debate continues over the EU bailout and government austerity measures designed to stave off bankruptcy. Last week, protests against government budget cuts and tax hikes turned deadly when three workers died when their bank was firebombed. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant reports from Athens.
A glorious spring day lures parents and their children to a fundraising event at an international school on the edge of Athens. This playground is a microcosm of Europe, with Greeks and a plethora of other nationalities rubbing shoulders. One subject dominates conversation, the multi-billion international rescue package, and whether the austerity measures demanded by the Eurozone and IMF will succeed. Grandmother Mirto Drakopoulou.
There's no other way because we have a big debt coming up in a few days, and if we don't pay that, we're going to go bankrupt. There's no alternative. I mean, Papandreou has been trying for months now to get this loan, and after they have accepted to give us the loan and they go in the streets, I mean, what's the point? It's useless, absolutely useless, and it's doing very great big deal of harm to our tourism, which is the only industry we have left.
Lambros Horigas, a professional administrator specialising in business startups, is critical of the Greek Prime Minister's crisis leadership.
It's part of Mr. Papandreou's logic. You know, I have a headache, cut off the arm. They didn't dig deep. They didn't have time to look into it. And to be frank, they wasted a lot of time. We're on the border of social unrest, of real revolution. What happened 3 days ago was an accident. Next time, I think it's going to be planned.
Last week's firebombing of the Marfin Bank, which caused the deaths of three staff, has horrified cancer specialist Stelios Grigorakis.
Dead people and all these things see where the revolution mentality leads us. On the other hand, a lot of people, serious people, think that if you don't be a little bit aggressive, politicians won't understand the mess that they've done.
Many northern Europeans are simultaneously appalled and bemused by Greece, but those living here temporarily can read the country better. Dutchman Victor van Baal.
I think it's going to be very difficult for them to implement all the measures that they have been announcing, and they will probably in a year or so, they will find out that they will still have a budget deficit, so I don't think that this is going to solve the problem.
Dimitri Willocks is a Belgian businessman.
I don't think that they ever should have entered the euro. No. From where I understand it, taking them out of the euro would be very bad for Europe as a whole. So,
will the Greek crisis spread to other Mediterranean countries? Sandra Trindade is from Portugal.
Portugal has been in a recession for the past 10 years, and they've been dealing with it probably very slowly and not properly, but they have been dealing with it. And I think you can't compare it to the Greek situation. The mentality is also very different. Well, you have the added corruption here and the whole black market scheme, so, and that's very big here. You won't find that anywhere else, I think, in Europe.
There are huge disagreements about ways to solve the crisis, but there is one area of unanimity. Most people want to see corruption and grand tax fraud punished. Photographer Vasilis Skopelitis.
Unless the government shows that there is some justice, shows that it will punish its own people and some people that they know, because they're involved in it, like many other Greeks are involved in it. Everyone made a profit out of this somehow. But people need to see some justice. If they don't see that justice, I don't think that the things will turn out to be peaceful. It will be violent.
So the mood is grim, but at least the skies are blue and the weather is fantastic. That's what I'm trying to concentrate on, says one of the parents, not wishing to discuss the downward spiral of his business and his country.
That report from the BBC's Malcolm Brabant in Athens, as we say hello to our listeners in Greece and Rome and London, with a reminder, if you have relatives abroad or are traveling there, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, where you can also download a podcast, take it with you wherever you go, hereandnow.org. When we come back, we pose the question, what if you had a teenager behind a locked door in his bedroom and you thought he was going into a diabetic coma? We'll hear that story and why one father's determined to create an artificial pancreas in 30 seconds here and now. About 3 million Americans live with type 1 or juvenile diabetes. To remind ourselves, type 1 is brought on when the body turns on itself, begins attacking insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. It can happen to children and adults. And it's opposed to type 2, which is connected to diet and lifestyle. Type 1 diabetics can't do anything to cure their condition. Their pancreas isn't producing insulin, and without insulin, blood sugars can't be regulated. The body shuts down. They will die. So type 1 diabetics become something akin to chemists, constantly testing their blood to see how much insulin to give themselves through shots or pumps. Parents of children with type 1 diabetes set alarms to monitor them around the clock. Well, former dot-com entrepreneur Jeffrey Brewer wants to change that. His son Sean was diagnosed back in 2002, and Jeffrey thinks a computer can do a better job of checking blood sugar levels and injecting insulin, and he's advocating for an artificial pancreas. We first read his story in Wired magazine, and Jeffrey Brewer joins us from Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, your son Sean is now a teenager. How was he first diagnosed? What made you think that he needed to be diagnosed?
He was spending some time with his grandmother, and who was previously a nurse, and she seemed to notice that he was drinking a lot of water and urinating very frequently and just seemed kind of lethargic, yeah. And went to the doctor. They did a very quick test of his urine to see if he had elevated blood sugar, and the doctor came back in 3 minutes later and said, he has type 1 diabetes. You need to take him to the emergency room. I felt like a ton of bricks had just been dumped on my head. I had very little understanding of what the difference between type 1 and type 2 was. I had a vague sense that type 1 was somehow very bad because you couldn't do anything about it.
And meaning that you can't change diet, you can't change lifestyle. You know, type 2 diabetes is also a terrible thing for children to go through. But type 1, there's just absolutely nothing you can do except, as a parent, begin to start monitoring their blood sugars, giving your son insulin shots. And remind us, it's dangerous if blood sugar is too low. It's dangerous if it's too high. Why?
If it's too low, a person can actually lapse into unconsciousness, coma, and potentially death. It's like not having enough glucose in the bloodstream is kind of like not having enough oxygen. Your brain can literally starve. Going too high, you can fall into what's called ketoacidosis, which could lead to death if untreated. But really, the more important day-to-day concern is that when you have high blood sugar, your body is suffering complications from that disease. The blood sugar levels actually damage the body over the long term.
Well, and so you enter this world of constantly measuring blood sugars, and there's a lot of factors. Diet, exercise can change blood sugar levels. It's hard for adults to do this, but for children, particularly hard. And even though Sean's now a teenager, you've had some scary episodes. Tell us.
My son had an episode where he took too much insulin accidentally in the evening. He usually sleeps late in the morning on weekends, but about 8 o'clock, my wife sort of sensed that there's something wasn't right. She called him on the speakerphone to try and rouse him and see if he was okay. Couldn't get him to respond. I was unfortunately away on a business trip. The door was locked. She had to call the fire department. Mm-hmm. So the New York City Fire Department came and busted down the door with an axe, found that he was lapsed into a coma, unresponsive. He had to be taken to the emergency room, was put into the ICU, and couldn't actually remember and speak his name for a full 24 hours. Mm. So it was really serious. Those are the kind of episodes that represent the consequence of not doing this well. Unfortunately, his insulin pump, which gives him a trickle flow of insulin all day long, is not a very smart device. And as he laid in bed and was actually going into a coma and seizure, the insulin pump was continuing to pump insulin into him, which was making the matter worse. And this is where we come to what we're trying to do at the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation by developing artificial pancreas technologies to take data such as blood glucose levels that can be now measured continuously by a device called a continuous glucose monitor, to basically tie that to the insulin pump, put some sort of computer algorithm in between, and affect how much insulin a person's getting based on that real-time data. That could have actually helped my son not end up in the hospital, and it's a device that we believe can exist in the very near future.
But can it really do that? Diabetics, as we said, are constantly monitoring their current blood sugar, but also calculating how they're going to feel after exercise or a big meal. And then if they're wrong, if they, say, feel groggy, they can drink a little orange juice to help bring their blood sugar up, but they may have to wait a few minutes for that to work, so it's risky. And I guess the question is, can an artificial pancreas really do all of these calculations?
The artificial pancreas would have the capability to see that a person's blood sugar is dropping rapidly and project whether or not in the future that person is likely to experience low blood sugar that could potentially render them unconscious.
But do you trust an artificial device to do that? I mean, our computers break down.
They do. And the key point here is when it fails, it must fail in a way which it doesn't leave anybody worse off than they would have been otherwise. So this has to require alarms that will require a patient, for instance, to do confirming blood tests with the finger prick and a finger stick meter in order to make sure that the numbers that the continuous glucose monitor are generating are consistent with what you get from one of those handheld meters, which is the standard of care today. But what I would like to step back and say is this is going to be an evolution of products over the next decade. We will not jump all the way to an artificial pancreas where you put it on and you forget you have type 1 diabetes. For instance, the first products I would foresee will protect you against the most extreme cases. For instance, if you're going dangerously low and going to suffer unconsciousness, then we need to cut off insulin. You shouldn't be having insulin pumped into you by an insulin pump if, in fact, your blood sugar is measuring dangerously low. So we'll start with devices which partially automate insulin and partially relieve the burden that people have with this disease today. And then over many generations of these products, I believe, we'll iterate towards ones that eventually will take care of it altogether. Yeah. But we won't start there.
Well, we know that you've joined the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. You've donated $1 million to get that organization to commit to a device, and that it was tough because, you know, manufacturers are afraid of liabilities, academics want perfection, the FDA is a little nervous about a computer control mechanism, everything we've just been talking about. But a separate question, you've invested so much of your own money, you obviously have this personal interest. What about another direction? What about creating a new flesh pancreas? What about stem cell research?
Well, obviously, at the end of the day, the JDRF is about a cure for this disease. We want to remove the disease entirely. That's going to be a while yet. There are some very promising technologies. You mentioned stem cells, the ability to potentially make beta cells that wouldn't be rejected by one's own body. That's going to be a while yet. And until we get to that cure, we want to make sure we keep people healthy and improve their quality of life.
Jeffrey Brewer, on a mission to create an artificial pancreas that will help people like his son Sean who have type 1 or juvenile diabetes in which their pancreas just doesn't work to produce insulin. Jeffrey, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
If you watched the opening ceremonies of the Vancouver Olympics, there's a good chance you thought, who is this? There's also a good chance you already knew. That's 16-year-old Nikki Yanofsky from Quebec. She's well known in Canada. She also sang the Canadian Olympic theme, I Believe.
I believe in the power that comes from a world brought together
I Believe went quadruple platinum, and Nicki's just released a new CD with songs she co-wrote as well as her version of classics like Take the A-Train, God Bless the Child, and I Got Rhythm.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man who can ask for anything more. I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man who can ask for anything more.
The new CD is called Nicki, and Nicki Yanofsky joins us from the Radio Foundation Studios in New York City. Welcome.
Hello.
I have to ask you about the Olympics. First of all, for those who didn't see it, you are tiny. And there you were on this huge stage with this huge audience around the world. What was that like, especially since the Olympics became a tribute to Canadian singers like Joni Mitchell and Katie Lang, Neil Young, Celine Dion? And there you are. What was that like?
That was like one of the best experiences to date for me in my life, and just to be a part of the Olympics in any way was such a pleasure, and to be able to be up there and kind of represent, you know, Canada in a way, and is just to be part of the Olympics, and I was so nervous.
Were any of those people that I named your influence?
I actually listened to more of like Ella Fitzgerald and Stevie Wonder. Joni Mitchell I love, you know, there's a bunch of Canadian artists that I really like, and like, you know, Bare Naked Ladies, I used to listen to them a lot. I just listened to whatever tickles my fancy at the time, you know, you just like something.
Well, you mentioned Ella Fitzgerald, and on your new CD, there's a song, First Lady, that you co-wrote, a tribute to her, and I want to listen to some of that, because we're hearing a very young person that we're speaking to, but somehow a very old soul gets into you when you sing. Let's listen.
First Lady, move me, tell me of your song. It's sad but true. Touched by the feeling, memories I adore. I'm glad I have you, my lady.
Nicki, what are you saying there? What did Ella Fitzgerald do for you, my lady?
She introduced me to jazz, so I pretty much owed her a song.
Yeah?
Especially with what she went through in her life and stuff. I just thought that I kind of owed her a song.
Well, you know, and we're reminded, too, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, was very poor. I think she had no family at one point.
She went through a lot. She was an orphan, and she went and she performed at the Apollo Theater, and she was going to dance. But then these two twin sisters went ahead of her, and they were so amazing that afterwards she was like, I can't go after them, I can't dance, what am I going to do? And she just started singing, and then that's how she found her voice. So it's a really cool story.
Yeah, you make a tribute to her. You also, as we said, record classics. Now, we want to listen to one, Over the Rainbow. It's very lovely.
That song means a lot to me because whenever I sing it, I think of my late grandmother. And, like, I just wanted to have her on the album. And, you know, and that song also, The Wizard of Oz, is, like, my favorite movie. And so...
Did your late grandmother love the song or just it reminds
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it just reminds me of her.
I said that you had a little bit of an old soul in you when you sang. Do you feel, when you sing, do you feel like some other soul inhabits you or something?
Lots of people have actually asked me that. They asked if I believe in reincarnation. And the thing is that, like, when I sing, I'm so in it that I don't know if I would. Like, it's just like I don't feel like anything else takes over me except the music.
Mama made hair. God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
I'm wondering, Nicki, we know you worked with producer Phil Ramone on this CD, not too shabby. He produced Burt Bacharach, Dionne Warwick, Billy Joel, Elton John. I mean, the list goes on and on. Paul McCartney, Paul Simon, and then you. And what I mean, this is so he's a font of experience, and you are relatively young. So what did you get from him?
He taught me a lot, and he's such a sweetheart. You'd think it'd be like all intimidating and everything, but he just makes everybody feel so comfortable. You know, he taught me that no matter how good you are at something, you have to remain humble, and you have to always just, you know, everybody's opinion is just as important as yours is. And he's so open-minded. It was great to have him on board, behind the board.
Well, let's get back to listening to some of the result. Here's another song that you co-wrote. It's called Bienvenue dans ma vie.
Dans ma vie.
Welcome.
I'm not French either. I messed up somewhat. I had to keep re-recording that song. I had to keep going back because I messed up the words when I was writing the French part. Like, I didn't have the good grammar or something.
So. Well, and that's so important in Canada.
Yeah, well, I'm bilingual, but, like, my writing is not that great. I could speak, I understand it really well, but, yeah, I'm from, like, the English part of Montreal, so.
So we want to get it right for both sides. Bienvenue dans ma vie. Welcome to my life. Let's listen.
Bienvenue dans ma vie. Tout est brillant ici. It's warm inside. My door's open wide.
Nikki Yanosky, obviously you're a jazzer. have you been tempted at all, though, by pop? Obviously you love jazz. But do you ever see yourself crossing over and leaving the jazz behind?
No, I would never. I don't think that you need to I don't think that you need to pick one in order to do the other, because I couldn't live without pop and I couldn't live without jazz. So I think that no matter what, I'm always going to be just singing everything. I was just, you know, are you a jazz singer? No, are you a pop singer? No, I'm just an everything singer. Just I like music.
Let's listen to another song, Cool My Heels. And it reminds us, you know, you're 16. and the hardest thing to tell a 16-year-old is to cool your heels, but is part of that sort of telling yourself?
Yeah, and it doesn't even, it could, it's pretty like a, you know, I was thinking about not only like the singing thing, but also like school or whatever, like if you're overwhelmed basically, or work, you know, it doesn't matter, it's just like you have to remind yourself to have fun and not take anything so seriously, and so just cool your heels.
That's Canadian singing phenomenon, Nikki Yanofsky. Her new CD is Nikki. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I